And in 1916, he published his new theory of gravity called general relativity. It generalizes his special theory of relativity, which did not include gravity. So the question this evening is, why would we want to modify Einstein's outstanding intellectual achievement? Well, since the 1970s and early 80s, a growing amount of observational data has been accumulating that shows that Newtonian and Einstein gravity cannot describe the motion of the outermost stars and gas in the galaxies correctly. Without postulating that if there's only visible matter, then you can't account for the galaxy dynamics. So you have to do something about it. And I'll convince you that this is the situation as we proceed. So here we have a simple pictorial description of what's happening. The observed speed of stars moving around in circular orbits in the galaxy, like a spiral galaxy. They're not fast enough. And we find that this is the case from the data, observational data, over many hundreds of galaxies since the 70s and 80s. A lot of this data was accumulated by Vera Rubin, a famous female astronomer, woman astronomer. And the way you get the data is to measure Doppler shifts from the stars so you can determine their motion in the galaxy and see whether they're moving at the right speed in accordance with Newtonian gravity. So it turns out that they aren't. If you measure the velocity, so-called rotational velocity of the stars, and you get this result, dashed line. This is velocity versus distance from the center of the galaxy. And this is not a minor correction. It's a very large effect, factors of 10 more. All right, so this is what the data shows. This is a typical galaxy, NGC 6503. And again, we have the rotational velocity, kilometers per second versus radius, and this is in kiloparsecs, thousands of parsecs. And this is a large galaxy. The data goes out to over 20 kiloparsecs in size. This is what's observed. This is Newtonian gravity and visible light from the stellar light. And this is what we do in the paradigm called dark matter. We postulate that there's a spherical halo of dark matter. The spherical halo is centered from goes out from the center of the galaxy, and it consists of dark matter. Now, so to fit this data, hundreds of galaxies, you cannot fit it with Einstein or Newtonian gravity, unless you postulate this dark matter, this invisible matter, which of course we're going to discuss in detail, or modify Einstein's gravity theory. There are two clear possibilities. Now, as you'll see as I proceed, there's no way out of this. you can't fit all the available data to date in astronomy, gravity, and cosmology without being faced with this possibility, these two possibilities. So, as I've said, we postulate this dark matter in the galaxies and also in clusters of galaxies. We have to strengthen the pull of gravity at the distance of galaxies and clusters of galaxies. And, well, the story started with the Swiss astronomer Zwicky, 1933, who used the Virial theorem in mechanics, Newtonian gravity, to check whether clusters of galaxies are stable. And he found that they weren't. If you just use Newtonian gravity, which of course is what you use for the weak gravitational fields. And that started it. Really not too much attention was paid to this over the years, not until the astronomers collected this data on the actual galaxies and their dynamics and saw the problem was clearly there, and also studied the dynamics of galaxies. Now, this invisible undetected dark matter removes any need to modify Newton's and Einstein's gravitational theories. Evoking the dark matter is a less radical, less scary alternative for most physicists than inventing a new theory of gravity. And this is why, as we'll see, 96% of matter and energy in the universe is invisible. And 96% of the community of astronomers, astrophysicists, and physicists believe in dark matter. So I'm sort of 4%, maybe less, of those who question this paradigm, as we'll see. So just to show you some observations, I took this picture of dark matter with my BlackBerry camera, and just to convince you that it exists. And this is a typical poster from a conference stating that it's out there, okay, if you start questioning it. So here we are. The matter and energy in the universe, it's a strange recipe. And the blue is the so-called cold dark matter, which I'll explain cold, the word cold, in a minute. It's about 30% of this pie. And we have the baryons, 4% or so. And then we have neutrinos, and then the CMB, cosmic microwave background, is 0.01%, and the so-called dark energy is about 70%. That's it. This is a very strange situation. I'm made of protons, electrons, quarks. So as I stand here in this room, I'm sort of pretty insignificant. Okay. I'm 4% less of what the universe consists of. Yes? Please ask questions.
So how can you calculate those numbers?
I will explain where they come from. Okay. Okay, so it's called dark matter because it's invisible. And we talk about cold dark matter, CDM, and this means that the dark matter particles, we presume that this stuff is made of particles, which is a logical reasoning. And these particles are heavy. They can't be too warm because otherwise dark matter halo would evaporate if it's dark matter is hot. The particles are heavy, so there's not much kinetic energy. And they tend to clump. You need the stuff to clump, as we'll see. The preferred model of dark matter is called WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, although warm dark matter has recently become more popular. In Europe, there are now conferences where they declare that the days of cold dark matter are over because there are too many problems fitting galaxies, whatever, as we'll get to this. And they have conferences stating that we don't want any more WIMPs. We've got to, they have a dial, and you turn up the temperature of dark matter, but you don't want to make it too hot because otherwise it'll evaporate. So you want a Goldilocks temperature for dark matter. Okay. This is called warm dark matter. Now, have these particles ever been detected? No. Effort has gone into experiments to detect these dark matter particles over more than three decades. And it's important to continue this investigation. It's very expensive. However, this is something one has to do to understand this whole situation. And the largest experiments, underground experiments, they have to be underground so you don't have too much noise against signal. And two of the experiments are Dharma, dark matter, and xenon 100. These experiments are conducted next to one another under the Gran Sasso Pass in Italy, and they've been going on some years. And a lot of controversy arises from these experiments. The xenon 100 is a tank of xenon gas, inert gas, and one hopes that the dark matter particles, the WIMPs, with a mass between 2 and 100 billion electron volts, GeV, hit nuclei in the gas, and there's a recoil, and you measure this, and you can determine that the particle exists, and it determines its mass. So, the lady who runs Xenon 100, they've published data recently, and they don't detect any events above background that can convince you that dark matter particles exist. Next door is Dharma, run by another lady, and they claim that as the Earth moves around the galaxy, that they see a modulation signal caused by the Earth running, moving through this dark matter and hitting these particles. And unfortunately, the Dharma, the lady running Dharma, has not released her raw data, so this has caused controversy because no one has been able to really check her claim that they've seen dark matter. But their result contradicts the results of Xenon 100 and other experiments such as Cogent, and that's the present situation. And Xenon 100 has been upgraded to a ton. It's called Xenon 1 ton. And the cross sections that we're getting now are tiny. They're down to something like 10 to the minus 45 centimeters squared in cross section to measure the recoil of the dark matter particles hitting the nuclei. And the xenon 1 ton is expected to get down to something like 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared, And now things get rough because you start hitting background. The noise level gets to the point where you really can't do much better. So my colleague David Klein, who works, he's at UCLA, he works on the, worked for years on the Xenon 100 experiment. I asked him, what happens when you get to 10 to the minus 47 centimeters squared? He said, I retire and quit. It's quite frustrating to work on experiments for years and not find anything. So he told me that when he goes to Washington to get more money, Congress, they told him that we're tired of you coming here with null results, nothing. Find something if you want this money. That's the world of experimental physics. It's quite expensive. All right, so if you can't find the dark matter within the next 100 years, then you have to modify Einstein gravity. This is what I'm coming here to propose to you. I may not convince you, but I just want you to see what the present situation is for the physics. Yes?
Yeah, I just want to ask, because from your previous slide, you said that cold dark matter does not interact with photons.
That what?
Dark matter does not interact with photons. Is that a necessity that we impose?
Well, we don't see it, so. I mean, it has to be very, very weakly interacting.
Yeah, but it could be, I mean, I'm not sure of the technology of our detection, but I would think that it's not possible for us to detect all frequencies of light, of radiation. So it could be emitting strongly at some frequency that is out of our technological detection. So what's wrong with that?
Well, the situation gets quite baroque. You have to be careful you're not getting into Ptolemaic astronomy with epicycles, okay? You don't see something, so you add an epicycle. You don't see something again, so you add another epicycle. And this is the tendency to what happens when you don't see something when you think it's there. So people have invented dark matter chemistry, dark matter atoms, gauge theories of dark matter, and any number of possible solutions to this problem. Okay, I'm not going to get into this, but there's a lot of work was on with this. I also have to mention that the experiments also concern themselves with astrophysics. So we anticipate that WIMPs, these particles, and the anti-WIMPs annihilate, say, this near the center of our galaxy, our Milky Way, and you would see particles being produced, photons, monogenetic photons, and there's been a claim that there's a 130 GeV photon line seen from a resonance, 130 GeV, and it's very controversial. Recently, the recent news is that the Fermilat, the spacecraft experiment that does these observations, sees more than one bump resonance. They see several, and they see one in the Earth limb, and you're not supposed to see that. And so it's the present situation with that is it's murky, dark. All right, so can we modify Einstein gravity and Newtonian gravity? Can this be done successfully? Yes. So I call my modified gravity MOG. It stands for modified gravity. This is distinguished it from another proposal called MOND, which is modified Newtonian dynamics, published by Mordecai Milgram way back in 1983. He's one of the pioneers in physics who said don't believe in dark matter. You had to modify gravity and so on. Okay. So let's turn to cosmology. Ingredients of the standard cosmology: general relativity, large scale homogeneity and isotropy, the Copernican principle for cosmology, as I mentioned, 5% baryons and electrons, 25% dark matter, 60% dark energy, your uniform cosmic microwave background everywhere at 2.73 degrees, and we have scale-free adiabatic fluctuations in the CMB of order 1 part in 10 to the 5. And as we know, the CMB is the cosmic microwave background radiation discovered serendipitously by Penzias and Wilson in 64. It's the afterglow of the Big Bang. All right, well, this is a picture of the evolution of the universe in standard cosmology. And here we have a popular paradigm called inflation. The universe inflates exponentially fast after the Big Bang, fractions of seconds after the Big Bang. And this solves what's called the horizon problem. So you can causally connect A to B in the universe and explain why the cosmic microwave background is so uniform across the sky. And there's the issue of the so-called flatness problem. Why observation we see that the universe is spatially flat to a few percent. And then, however, I have my model, which is not inflation. And this is called VSL, variable speed of light cosmology. The speed of light is very large in the early universe. It goes through a phase transition. And I have various versions of this theory. One of them, I think, is the most elegant explanation. It's called the biometric gravity theory. And it's as successful as inflation in describing the data. You get a scale invariant spectrum. You solve the flatness problem, da-da-da. But from a sociological point of view, it's not as popular as inflation. Then, some 400,000 years after this year, the Big Bang, you have a surface of light scattering. Photons start streaming out, and you get the first stars 200 million years after, and the present day, 13.7 billion years. In the standard cosmology, as we will call it, concordance model, the lambda CDM model. Lambda is the Einstein's cosmological constant. CDM is called dark matter. We can determine the age of the universe pretty accurately. So we've been through the issue of dark matter being collisionless, and using what, as we'll see, what's called lensing, the lensing as predicted by general relativity, we can determine the distribution of matter in the universe.
Cluster might suggest that dark matter may have some collision among themselves.
Which data?
The Bode cluster.
I'm getting to that.
Yeah.
Okay. MAG. So, dark matter is inferred at present from the motion of visible matter in a gravitational field. And that's how we know it exists. If it does, until you see it in lab experiments, as I've described. So, I've been the modified gravity person for many years. I did a PhD at Cambridge and published my first modified gravity theory. Fred Hoyle was my supervisor. For a while. He was not interested in modifying Einstein gravity, Nobody was at the time. But I published the papers. So. And then I proceeded to study other modified gravity theories over the years. Of course, I've done other things in physics. I don't labor over this all the time. So what first you learn that to modify Einstein gravity theory is a tough business. And there are many failed modified gravity theories. I don't know, lots of them. And there's a cemetery somewhere with headstones with RIPs, modified gravity, all over. And it's hard, because Einstein's theory is a beautiful theory. It's elegant. It fits the data for the solar system very well. We'll get to that. And it's tough. However, this mark could possibly work. So I had to have to do something. So I can either change the geometry. And what am I? There are three candidates for MOGs. One is my colleague Philip Mannheim, who does conformal gravity. And I'll explain that a little later. And there's Milgram's MOND. And for 25 some more years, Bekenstein, famous for Hawking radiation, Bekenstein-Hawking radiation, labored to make Milgram's MOND relativistic. You can't just have a non-relativistic theory of gravity, as I'll explain later. It's not good enough. You want to compete with Einstein, you don't want to be walking with crutches, okay? You have to be running rather fast to do this. So Bekenstein spent all these years and he produced what's called TeVS, tensor vector scalar gravity. So these new fields are sourced by ordinary matter, baryonic matter, such as protons and electrons. This is an important issue. In MOG, a real MOG, in the absence of visible matter, the gravitational field and the new fields that you add to modify Einstein vanish. And you get Minkowski spacetime. There is no gravity. In dark matter models, they're not theories, by the way. There is no theory of dark matter. These are models. When the ordinary matter is zero, you still have gravity, obviously, because the dark matter is producing a lot of gravity. That's an essential difference between my MOG theory and a dark matter model. So this is a significant difference. Okay, so fully relativistic modified gravity MOG, which I call scalar tensor vector gravity, STVG. I published this in 2006. And we'll see how it can fit all the data that I've been able to tackle. The STVG has an extra degree of freedom, a vector field called the pion, whose curl is a skewed field that couples to the matter. There's a fifth force. The gravitational field itself is described by symmetric Einstein metric tensor. So I started off with a non-symmetric gravity theory some years ago, way back in 1979. Published in Physical Review. The title of the theory was called, the paper was New Theory of Gravity. And I had a non-symmetric metric and a non-symmetric connection. And I converted Einstein's work on this kind of structure on unified field theory, unifying gravity and electromagnetism. I converted it into a modified gravity theory because it cannot describe electromagnetism. As he suggested, it's wrong. So my astronomy friends complained it's too difficult. They like Milgram's MOND because it's a simple little equation. And anyone who knows first year physics can understand it immediately. My theories are much more complicated. And so I said, all right, I'll go away and construct a simpler one. And I constructed what I call MSTG, metric skew tensor gravity. And this was a the son of NGT, and I went and said, what do you think about this? Still too difficult. All right, so I went back and said, I'll construct a simpler version. And this is the absolute simplest theory I can construct, which is fully relativistic, is fully stable, and fits the data. And I haven't asked them what they think about it, but they may still think it's too difficult. Anyway, so what I have is, in addition to this massive vector field phi mu, I have a coupling constant big G, Newton's constant, which is not constant, and it has the vector field has a scalar field mu, which is the effective mass of the phion field. All right. Now, those who want to reinvent gravity are faced with a nightmare. In 1950-1960, when Einstein published his paper on general relativity, he had three tests, so-called classical tests. He predicted the perihelion advance of Mercury, and just knowing Newton's constant and the mass of the Sun, 43 seconds per century, very brilliant. This got rid of the dark matter puzzle that we were hearing, those who went to the talk earlier today. We got rid of the planet Vulcan, which is supposed to be a planet running between Mercury and the Sun, which would explain the perihelion advance of Mercury, which it did, if it existed. It took 67 years to get rid of Vulcan. Le Verrier, the astronomer who discovered the perihelion advance of Mercury anomaly, claimed, even on his deathbed, that Vulcan existed. And 67 years went by before Einstein published his paper doing a 50% modified gravity works. Einstein's theory is a modified gravity theory. He modified Newtonian gravity. And 50%, it doesn't work. Okay. So today, with my gravity theory, I'm faced with considerable difficulties. The theory has to explain the accurate solar system experiments. These experiments are very accurate. Blending of light, preferred frame effects, the Cassini experiment, spacecraft Cassini, which measures the time delay and signals, Doppler signals going from NASA to the spacecraft and back, and so forth. Einstein's theory of gravity works very well in the solar system. The CMB data, including the power spectrum data, and the power spectrum is a measure of the fluctuation of temperature or density against the angular size. The formation of proto-galaxies in the early universe and the growth of galaxies, the so-called growth of structure. Gravitational lensing data for galaxies and clusters of galaxies. The lensing is the bending of light by massive bodies such as a star or galaxy. I'll explain this in a little while. You need a fully relativistic theory to do this. You cannot use a non-relativistic theory like Milgram's Mond to do lensing. Yes?
When you say it has to include the current data, isn't it extra tricky? Because even interpreting the data is now tricky, right? Because normally when you say, oh, we on the x-axis, it's a distance. But this distance is deduced from the data based on GR, I suppose. So if you have another theory, then...
Well, not necessarily. Are you, for example, if you want to measure the distance to some object out there in the universe, you measure the it's called the luminosity distance, which is the ratio of the apparent luminosity capital L over divided by 4 pi times the flux. So if you can measure the flux, you can get a result more or less independently of, provided you know the redshift distance of the object. But it's a good point you make, because a lot of what's done is run through GR. You believe in GR. If you're dark matter, you believe in GR. The emerging bullet clusters and APO 520. The accelerating expansion of the universe, so-called dark energy. Okay, so here's a bit of maths. I'm trying not to put too much maths into this talk. The talk is getting increasingly more difficult as we proceed. Okay. So we have an action principle, and these are the four. It contains these four ingredients. We start with Einstein gravity, Einstein Hilbert action. Lambda is a cosmological constant. We have an action for this vector field phi, a phion as I call it, massive vector field. This is the mass. This is the curl of the vector field, b mu nu. Root minus g is the usual root minus g. And this is a potential for the phion field. And then we have scalar fields. We have the gravitational constant varying, which is a very important thing, it turns out. And omega is a dimensionless constant. This theory is fully stable classically. Many gravitational, modified gravitational theories are not stable. The Bekenstein's theory has been checked by papers in Physical Review. And it's not stable. It only lasts, the sun only lasts 2 weeks. So that's not enough time to get a vacation in the Caribbean, okay? So this is an important issue. You have to have a stable theory. This is one of the reasons why modified gravity theories fail.
What are the physical roles of the self-interaction potential? What is the physical role of this self, like V mu phi, V g g, V mu,
yeah.
Mu, like self-interaction potentials, what do they play? Like, what dynamics do they play in this theory?
It's because mu is the effective mass of the phion. So I started off by making everything as general as possible. I once talked to Murray Gell-Mann, famous physicist, and he said, when you write a theory, you make completely as general as possible, otherwise someone comes along and sticks something in later and claims it's his theory, okay? So I originally had omega varying in my published paper, but now it's always constant in the solutions, so I can draw back, I've done that, draw back, make omega constant. I have a spheric.
Potentials give rise to some force fields of themselves, right? Because you're going to vary the action to produce the equation.
Yeah, I do a variational principle.
Yes, yes, sure.
I grind out field equations.
What kind of forces do these self-interaction potential give rise to? That's my question.
Yeah, well, I like to put those to zero, because the potentials are, this is usually some unknown thing that you stick in, okay?
Sure.
So, but then I sometimes don't put it to zero. I mean, I play around with the theory. So I have a spherically symmetric static solution. I vary S field equations, solve them for a point-like solution equivalent. This is equivalent to the Schwarzschild solution in general relativity. And this is my metric, and this is the solution for the G naught naught part. And Q5 is the fifth force charge. And I have two constants of integration, E and D. These are constants of integration. They're not parameters in the Lagrangian. So these are not free parameters. And this is the solution here. So what I'm getting is a Yukawa solution for the time component of the vector field, Yukawa. So the constant of integration, I take two or three galaxies and solve to fit the rotation curves, and that determines the constant of integration D and E. And then they're universal. I now have to fit 100 galaxies with one parameter, the mass to light ratio. Okay. I get a modified acceleration law. This is it. And alpha is determined in terms of the constant of integration E. And there's another constant of integration G infinity. That's the value of the Newtonian constant, which is varying at infinity. And this gives me the rotation velocity of a galaxy. Here it is. Everything is fixed. And mu, the infective mass, is constant of integration D over root M. And we immediately get the so-called Tully-Fisher law, namely that the velocity to the fourth power is proportional to the mass. In Newtonian gravity, it's the square of the velocity that's proportional to the mass. And we find from many observations of galaxies that this Tully-Fisher law holds for galaxies. So we're already beginning to see some truth, okay? This is another way of expressing the rotation velocity. And you can see here that you take the fourth power and the thing is proportional to M. Okay, fitting galaxy rotation curves and clusters. Now we start. So I discovered way back when I first published this paper, I'm way going back to 1995 when I first published in Physics Letters B and other journals, that I had to learn all this stuff myself. Nobody does anything for you. You have to do it yourself, okay? So you have to go away and learn astronomy and cosmology and heaven knows what else to do this. Don't sit around and wait for someone to do it. Okay. So I managed to pick up a couple of, one graduate student, Joel Brownstein at Waterloo, and a couple of collaborators since. So Brownstein and I published a paper in the Astrophysical Journal fitting 101 galaxies. So we took two or three galaxies, did an averaging over the constants of integration, and with one parameter, mass to light ratio, we fitted all the rest. Now you can't do that with dark matter. Dark matter, you put in what's called a mass profile to describe this spherical symmetric halo. And it has two parameters at least. And maybe one more if you want a triaxial halo, because that fits the center of the galaxy better, where you can get rid of the cusp problem. And so you have 200 or 300 parameters to fit 100 galaxies. Now, does that mean I'm right? No! It just makes me feel good, okay? It's encouraging. Okay, so as you go away from the galaxy, the mark gravity decreases and you finally get back to Newton Kepler, which is nice. This is the way it should look physically. So here we go. These are some typical fits. These are some gold plate galaxies where the data is pretty good. And this is the curve here for MOG, and the curve here. And this green curve is the green curve is the stellar light, and the other one is the hydrogen gas. There's a lot of hydrogen gas in these And the gas and the light, of course, from stars is visible matter. And in there is Milgram's Mond, which does very well for galaxies. But you can't see the difference between my fit and his, even though the modified acceleration laws are quite different. Now, this is another couple of galaxies. And it's very interesting that the gas, this green dash curve, has a kink in it. And the prediction of mine, when you put in what's called the photometric data into the calculation, gives the kink. So this means that gravity is following light. This is visible. And the gravity is following the light. You can't get this with dark matter, because the dark matter isn't seeing the light. Very important details. The devil is in the details in this business. It's the very detailed things that determine whether you're going in the right direction. Merging clusters mystery. Large clusters collide, and in 2006, Chloe et al. Tucson claimed that the Bullock cluster proved the existence of dark matter. So I got into this, and there was a NASA report on the basis of the Bullock cluster result, claiming that dark matter had been proved to exist. So I thought, well, it's a challenge. So with Brownstein, we published a 29-page paper in Astrophysical Journal, full of color pictures and I don't know what, and showed that this is not true. The MOG does fit the Bullock cluster without dark matter. And the Royal Astronomical Society in England had its press release, which annihilated the NASA press release, okay? Because canceled it out. So recently, about 5 years ago, the astronomy group in Victoria University and Caltech published a paper in Astrophysical Journal claiming that they saw a clump of dark matter at the center of the galaxy. It's called Abel 520. And this is not good, because what happens is that the galaxies collide, the dark matter is collisionless, it goes out to the side, and the hot gas plasma made of protons, electrons, sticks in the middle. However, if you have a clump of dark matter in the middle, the dark matter particles are not separating as they should, and you have to explain how they stick. You have sticky dark matter, and you have a lot of trouble. So, however, the MOG fits both the Bullock cluster and Abel 520, a recent paper to be published. However, the Chloe et al. People have come out with a paper saying that they don't agree with the dark matter clump. It's to do with the properties of weak lensing. This is light coming through from distant galaxies, sources, comes through the emerging clusters, and there's a big argument going on about this. So the present situation is the emerging clusters do not prove anything, because they can't agree with one another, okay? And we have to find out who's right. This could take time. Gravitational lensing. So very quickly, we have a galaxy here, Earth. General relativity is a lens, and you get a distortion, a lensing distortion of the galaxies as the light goes through, and so forth. Modified gravity has to be relativistic, because only a relativistic theory can predict lensing. If you have a non-relativistic theory like Mond, you cannot do lensing. It's a purely relativistic effect, and it's the one thing that causes great difficulty in modifying gravity. Yes?
Regarding the previous slide?
Yeah.
So the parameter that was fixed with the other plot, with the velocities, was that the only parameter? So the were any parameters free for this plot?
Same parameters.
Okay.
Yeah, so I haven't mentioned that we also have to do dynamics of clusters. This was another paper in Monthly Notice of the Royal Astronomical Society with Bernstein, this graduate student. And Mark fits. Mon doesn't fit. These are well-known facts. Mon doesn't, or Bekenstein's theory doesn't fit clusters. And it doesn't fit the Bullitt cluster. Okay, so this is very quickly, this is the prediction for MARG, MNRES 2009, and it looks just like the Einstein prediction, except for Einstein alpha zero. This is the alpha that occurred in the solution for the spherically symmetric solution of the field equations. So the lensing mass is equal to 1 plus alpha times m. M is the baryonic mass. And here you have the formula. Again, you use the same constants of integration to fit the galaxies. And we fit 21 galaxies. This is called strong lensing. The data isn't all that good, but you can tell that if you don't have either dark matter or modified gravity, you can never fit this data. Einstein cannot work. So again, we mentioned April 5 to 0. And, okay. And this is the present controversy. I'll skip this. These are the parameters that fit the April 5 to 0. Since I don't have dark matter, I don't have to worry about whether dark matter is clumping in the center or not, because there isn't any dark matter. So I can not worry about that. This is something that dark matter people have to worry about. I simply fit the data for the lensing. Another issue is the infall velocity for the Bullitt cluster. Mark can solve this problem, whereas dark matter has difficulties. Here's a picture, of course, the usual famous picture. This picture is shown whenever there's a talk on dark matter. This is the poster boy, okay? So if I'm in the front row, I put up my hand and say, what about April 520? And often the speaker says, what's that? And I say, well, you know, there's a paper published and it doesn't agree. This is April 520. There's the dark matter clump. Lensing contours for fitting April 520. Okay, there's another test of MARG globular clusters. At the edges of our Milky Way, there are these spherically symmetric concentrations, dense concentrations of globular clusters. And their size, MARG is only triggered when you get to a mass bigger than 10 to the 5, 10 to the 7 solar masses, and the object is big enough. So the globular clusters have a mass of 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 solar masses, and they only go out to something like 20 parsecs, 30, 40 parsecs, not kiloparsecs. So MARG predicts that the so-called dispersion velocity, which is like the rotation velocity, is Newtonian. And indeed, the data says I'm right. Okay. And this is MOND. It doesn't fit, whereas I do. So that's the present situation published. This is a nice test of modified gravity. Now let's return to cosmology. We've seen this picture many times, and I have to explain cosmology. So I used to give talks, and I said, I fit 100 galaxies with one parameter, fantastic. So someone puts up their hand and says, what about cosmology? I haven't done that yet. Go away, okay? So go away and do cosmology. So I do the cosmology, give another talk. Well, I fit cosmology and galaxies and clusters. What about the lensing? I haven't done that yet. Go away. Go away and do lensing. And so it goes. There's always a constant problem with data, because it keeps coming in. It's absolutely enormous data. When I was a student, cosmology was a mathematical subject. It wasn't really a science. I'm not talking about the 17th century, by the way. I'm not that old, okay? And now it's become a science. It's quite remarkable how it's developed into a science over the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century. It's an amazing story. Okay, so by the way, I get rid of singularities at the Big Bang. This is another issue which I don't have time to cover. I get a bounce from my mark. So, how can I do I fit the data? Well, one of the showpieces of the Lambda CDM model is the angular power spectrum. This is the oscillations in the plasma fluid, baryon photon plasma fluid, before the surface of last scattering emerges. And you have to fit this, and we do reasonably well. I tried using the codes written to fit Lambda CDM. It's called CMB Fast, for example. And you can't use it to do modified gravity theory. It took about 20 graduate students and postdocs to write that code, starting at MIT with Böttinger. So my collaborator, Victor Toth, and I looked at this and started rewriting it. And after 2 weeks, we quit, because it's too much work for two people. There are only 8 hours of work every day, okay, so there's a limit to what can be done. Fitting the acceleration of the universe, here it is, the blue curve sits right on top of Lambda CDM, Mach sits on top of Lambda CDM. Remember, there's no dark matter, but we have to assume something about the dark energy, but I'll get to that. And the dark energy comes out of the theory through these potentials, the VFI potential, which there was a question was asked about that. Now, what is happening is that every time someone publishes a result based on dark matter paradigm, I immediately sit down and do it. I have this little machine, so I turn the crank, okay? And I put in DM on one end of the machine, turn the crank, and out comes the Mach solution that fits the data just as well. So you think to yourself, well, this can go on forever, okay? And is this a satisfactory situation? No. Physics theories have to be falsified. Otherwise, it's not physics. And you should hear about this now in this room, because a great deal of physics goes on at present which cannot be falsified. There are no data. Beware. Okay. So how do I tell the difference? Okay. It turns out that you can. It's quite remarkable. You look at what's called the matter power spectrum, and this is effectively working out the statistical distribution of matter in the universe, in the sky, okay? And you get a power spectrum, the amount of power obtained from this matter. And here it is, and this is versus K. K is the wave vector, and this is the early universe, this is the later universe. This is the data from the MITS, STSS analysis. And this is what happens. This is, you have to construct what's called a transfer function. This is the baryon part. This is the cold dark matter part. You get the power spectrum from this, just squaring this up, factors of pi and stuff. And this is the equation for perturbations, which we have to work out in Mach. It's been done. And we get a G, effective G, given by here. Again, this is our alpha, this is the mu, and this is the Yukawa screening part coming in. And it turns out there's no dark matter. This baryon part of the transfer function is a Bessel function. And we all know that Bessel functions oscillate. So you get unit oscillations if you don't have dark matter. Wrong. If you try to fit with Einstein without the dark matter and without modifying it, you're way up here. This is the dash curves. There's no way this will ever fit the data. Never. This has to convince that you cannot use Einstein gravity for this kind of stuff without doing something. So whenever someone says that GR is wonderful, it works, and it agrees with the data, wrong. It doesn't agree with the data out there. It agrees with the data in the solar system. It's not the same as a complete theory. So, what happens? Well, since you don't have data that's exact, you have to put in a window function. So you have a window function, and it has a width that determines the lack of accuracy of the statistical distribution of the matter data. And when you put that in, it damps out the oscillations of MOG. And you get this picket fence. This red picket fence is as good a fit to the data as lambda CDM. Okay, the chi-square is just as good. So what do? We sit around and count galaxies, millions of them. And the size of the window function decreases. And you're going to see two things happen. You keep the smooth curve, which means dark matter exists, or you begin to see unit oscillations appearing. And if the unit oscillations begin to appear significantly, then you can't explain this with dark matter, because dark matter has no pressure. You need pressure collisions to get acoustic oscillations. So I have a bet with Jim Peebles at Princeton about 2 or 3 years ago. And he said, I bet $10 that when you get enough galaxies, you get this blue smooth curve. I said, you're on. And do you want to bet more than $10? No. Okay. The bet's still on. The problem is that I was very enthusiastic about this, but not so much now. Because in order to determine this issue, you need galaxies that go into the beginning of the universe, large redshift. They're called LRGs. And the LRGs are for a redshift of 0.5 or less. And that's not, you can't, this is the area where you have to make the distinction. Down here, there's a lot of noise in the late universe. And this, you can't use this data to determine anything here. You can't see the oscillations if they occur. So we have to wait for these galaxies. It takes a long time. This is the way. Nature doesn't make it easy. So there you have it. It's possible to generically tell the difference between dark matter and modified gravity. It needn't be MOG. My MOG, as long as it fits the crest of the oscillations sit along the data, you fit the data. Does dark energy exist? I just want to make some comments about this. In 1992-95, I published a paper in the Astrophysical Journal, and I invented what's called the void cosmology. I pictured to myself that I'm standing inside a large void, and we know the voids exist, we see them in the galaxy survey data. And light comes through the void from galaxies. This is before supernova, 98, and I calculated the luminosity distance and found that because the space-time is expanding faster inside the void than outside, it looked as if the galaxies were dimmed compared to where they should be. And therefore, the universe appeared to be accelerating. But the bubble, spherical symmetric bubble, obtained by solving Einstein's field equations, inhomogeneous exact solutions collimator Tolman Ponty solutions. It's called the Hubble bubble. And this Hubble bubble is embedded in an Einstein to City universe, or another kind of universe, which is not accelerating. So the overall universe is not accelerating in its expansion globally. There is no dark energy in this model, and lambda zero, it says exactly the opposite to lambda CDM. And I did put in dark matter at the time because I wasn't working on dark matter issue. And I didn't modify Einstein's field equations to do this. So what does this mean? By the way, the latest review paper by Chris Clarkson, it's on the archive, AstroPH, has something like 230 citations. And when I first published it, there was a dead silence. And it's grown into a major industry. And this model fits all the data. Lambda CDM fits. There's some controversy about this because Lambda CDM people are not happy about this. What does it mean? It means we don't understand cosmology. There's still a lot we don't understand. Now, one of the criticisms of this model is that you have to violate the Copernican principle, that we're not in the center of the universe somewhere. However, the Lambda CDM also has a violation of the Copernican principle in time. This one is in space, the other one is in time. It's called the coincidence problem. Why is the acceleration happening now, so to speak? Why did they cross, the matter density cross with the constant lambda? Okay, so very quickly, running out of time. I've done work on modification of stellar collapse and black holes. We have a black hole solution. The vector field phi mu is repulsive, so when you enter into the black hole, you can never get to r equal to zero, the singularity. You can never see it. And there are two horizons, even though you only have matter as the source. So it's not the same solution as the Schwarzschild solution. More work has to be done on this. One of the things that's forgotten about black holes is that you will never see a black hole horizon form from Earth. You have to go up there, like in the Walt Disney movie, Black Holes, the black hole. You have to go up next to the black hole to look and see what's really going on. From here, we never see the horizon form. It's not possible. That's it. Thank you. This is my book. This is a commercial at the end, okay? This book has no equations. I think there was one equation, E equals mc squared. And it explains in words what I've been doing and what other people have been doing. It's the history of cosmology and gravity, actually.
Does anyone have any further questions?
Yes.
Are there any of you came across any evidence and suggestions and experimental data that would show its existence?
See what?
The fion field that you introduced?
No. The only evidence is fitting the data. Okay. But then you don't see dark matter.
Yeah.
And you don't ever see gravitons.
Yeah, but for fitting what kind, I mean, why particularly did you choose a fion field, for example, in order to fit what kind of data? I mean, so this fion field is self-repulsive, basically. Is that?
Is what?
Is repulsive, is it? I mean.
That's correct.
And my point is, what kind of dynamics does it play in the evolution of the universe, for example?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what kind of new dynamics does it give us in order, I mean, what we have not detected by Einstein's gravity, for example?
Okay.
Is there any new dynamical structure in this?
Right. Well, one immediate result is that that when you go from a large-scale structure like a spiral galaxy, and you're approaching the solar system, then the repulsive gravity of the phi mu cancels the attractive gravity of Einstein-Hilbert. So when you get into the solar system, you just get Newton.
Okay.
Otherwise, you're not fitting the solar system data and you're dead.
Okay.
Most modified gravity theories fail because they don't fit the solar system data. And another problem is the fact that in the solar system, Einstein gravity is just purely metric, geometrical, because of the equivalence principle. And it's that theory that's determining the accuracy of the experiments. So I have to be able to get from a theory which adds fields, which is not metric, to a theory which is metric. This is not easy, okay?
Sure,
yeah. And this has required a lot of work and thought. It's a very fundamental issue. It's an extraordinary thing, actually. So, if you don't succeed, then the theory is dead, because you're not fitting the data.
Okay, if there's no more questions, I want to thank the speaker again.